This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Psychologist Dr. Dan Gottlieb was in his mid-50s and had been a quadriplegic for more than 20 years when his young grandson, Sam, was diagnosed with autism. In Gottlieb's new book, Letters to Sam, he collects the letters he's written to his grandson in which he describes his own experiences of being different. It was a car accident that left Gottlieb with quadriplegia, but it was after the accident that he made his mark in his field. He opened a private practice. For the past 20 years, he's had a very popular psychology call-in show called Voices in the Family. It's on WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And he writes a column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Dan Gottlieb's grandson, Sam, will be 6 next month. Why did you want to write a book of letters to your grandson?
When he was born, I was a 56-year-old quadriplegic. I had been a quadriplegic for 20 years. I know my life expectancy is shortened. I live as Sartre said we should live, with death on my shoulder. I knew that anything could take me out, and I could feel that my body was beginning to fatigue. I wanted to share with Sam what I've learned, both as a psychologist and a quadriplegic, because I did not believe I would be in the world that he would see. And I wanted him to know who I was, how I saw the world. This is something most of us don't get from our grandparents. I wanted him to have that. And then when I learned that he had autism, it became more urgent. I felt I had more to tell him about being different. And the book has turned into two things, a book of love letters for my grandson, but in a way, it's a prayer for the world. The prayer is that the world becomes softer, more gentle, more loving, that the world Sam grows up in is safer than the world you and I are living in today.
You end the book by explaining to Sam that it might soon be time to say goodbye. And you explain that you've been near death several times. And you just said that for quadriplegics, death often comes sooner. Is that what you said? That the
yes.
life is that true? That medically, the life expectancy is shorter.
Yes, yes, it is. I went to my urologist. My bladder is beginning to fail on me, which is typical of spinal cord injuries. That is our weak link more than anything else. And I said to him, "Be blunt with me. How long now do we have? Are we talking 1 year, 5 years, 10 years? He said, "I'll tell you the truth." He said, "You're the first generation of quadriplegic that's lived this long. We don't know. We have no idea." So I have all the hopes in the world that I'll live another decade. Meanwhile, I am so grateful every day. I am so grateful for every season that changes.
I know that the car accident that left you paralyzed nearly killed you. So that forced you to change your life. You've had a few close calls with death in the past few years. Did those close calls almost allow you to change your life? You know, allow you to make changes that you actually wanted to make and felt that you couldn't?
Yes. Yes. What a great question. The vision I have about my accident is that when my neck broke, my soul began to breathe. I became the person I always dreamt I could be and never would have been if I didn't break my neck. And with each time I faced death, I became more of who I am and less worried about what others might think of me. This last time was 2 years ago. I've cut my practice back. I don't work quite as hard. That's a lie. I work just as hard. I don't work quite as hard on things that pay, but I work just as hard, but I spend more time with things I love. I am involved with the Boys and Girls Club. I'm involved in more volunteer activities. I'm involved in a program to deal with violence between city and suburban children. I spend my time trying to make the world better in my own way for Sam and for all the Sams in the world.
Tell me how you think you became the person who you wanted to be and you thought you should be only after you broke your neck.
My genetic loading would have me being more depressed more of the time. My parents were both mild to moderately depressed their whole lives. And I think I would have been. The good news about quadriplegia is because I felt alienated as a child, I lived my whole life up until 33 thinking that if I made enough money, I'd be okay. If I was successful as a psychologist, if I was stronger. And when I broke my neck, I lost all hope. And that was a gift. I lost hope that I would ever walk again. I lost hope that I would ever be one of the kids again. My only choice was if I was going to live, I would live as me, not as the person I wanted to be ideally. It was liberating and terrifying.
I mean, did you feel that there were certain pressures that you or other people had put on yourself to become somebody who you weren't particularly?
We're all like that.
No. Not me ever.
Lectures, children. Most people I know spend their lives trying to be the person they think they should be and never get to discover who they are. And that's the gift, one of the gifts, the fact that I can't run away from my demons. Literally, I have to sit with them. The person I wanted to be, I had always dreamed of being a visionary, of being a peacemaker. But I had to be a psychologist. I had to be a father. I had to be the kind of man I thought I was supposed to be. And when I broke my neck, that was gone. I had to be the kind of man I was.
How did the accident happen in which you broke your neck?
I was traveling on the Pennsylvania Turnpike westbound. There was an 18-wheeler traveling eastbound. He lost his whole wheel, not his tire, but his whole wheel. It bounced across the turnpike and crushed my car. Thank God I was alone in the car, because whoever else would have been there would have been dead. And I'm also lucky that there was a car right across the street. And in that car, who watched the accident, there was an RN.
No.
So she ran across. As soon as she saw me, she knew I was a quadriplegic, and she knew not to take me out of the car. Me, being the person I am, when the ambulance came, I said, call everybody I know to come here right away. I knew I needed a network. I knew I needed a support system.
Did they come?
Boy, did they come. I was in Ephrata, Pennsylvania, which is about an hour from Philadelphia. And they came. They came in droves. And they still do. I am sometimes embarrassed by my wealth.
I imagine that you don't remember the moment of impact.
No.
Is that a good thing, that you don't remember that?
I think it is. The last thing I remember is a big black thing in the sky. And that's the last thing I remember. I think, though, all of us, if we can use that metaphorically, all of us have been hit by a big black thing coming out of the sky. You know, it's a lump. It's a doctor saying, I think it's malignant. It's a spouse saying, I don't want to be in this marriage anymore. I'm no different than anybody else in that regard.
Were you certain that you wanted to live while you were in the hospital?
No.
Dealing with the news?
No, not at all. Not at all. I was surrounded with people who loved me. I was surrounded with people who told me I had value, and still I wanted to die. I was taken to intensive care one night, and there I lay in bed in a halo vest, which is a grotesque apparatus with where your head is bolted by metal bolts in order to immobilize your neck. I'm laying there with IVs, with catheters, looking at the ceiling, wishing I could go to sleep and not wake up. A nurse came up to my bedside one night. I couldn't see her face because I couldn't turn my head. She said, "You're a psychologist, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." She said, not knowing I was suicidal, she said, "Does everybody feel suicidal at some point in their lives?" And I said, "Well, it's not unusual, but if you want to talk, come back after your shift." She pulls a chair up, 11 o'clock that night. We talk for an hour. Of course, it was her. She tells me about her life. I refer to a therapist. She leaves. I close my eyes, and I say to myself, "I can live with this." That woman saved my life because she asked something of me. All these people told me I had value, but it had no meaning. She showed me that I had value by asking something of me, by allowing herself to be vulnerable with me and asking my help.
And you continued to be a therapist. You started your own practice. You didn't have your own practice before the accident, right?
It was a very small one, but I started my practice right after the accident.
So you started your practice, and then eventually you got a radio show, which you still have, in which you help people and give people advice and also discuss the latest issues in psychology. You have a column in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Do you feel like your approach to working with your clients changed when your life was changed by the accident?
It changed dramatically, but I don't know how. I went to my supervisor because I was scared by the intensity of my work, and he didn't get it. So I went to a man who was nationally known in the field of family therapy. And he didn't quite understand it, but he said, "You know what? Call my analyst in Atlanta, Georgia." And I called him, and he was so moved by me, by my story, by what happened. We spoke on the phone every week, but he didn't get it. He was so outraged by the injustice I had to live with every day that that's all he could focus on. And he wasn't able to help me with my work. And once again, I knew I was alone here, and I had to sort it through on my own with my patients. We had to come through this together, and we do it together. We are both vulnerable.
When you returned to therapy after the accident, were you resentful of some of your clients and thinking like, "Oh, well, you think you have big problems? You can walk."
I had that experience once. I was working with a man who was being treated for alcoholism, and in a drunken stupor, he killed a girl. And I'm watching him in the chair rationalize this. He got off for some reason. I'm watching him in the chair rationalize this, wiggling his foot as he did it. And I'm thinking, I would like to kill this man for what he's done. That was the only time I felt it. I did have those emotions. When I was in the hospital, I was looking out my window at a street, at a man living on a vent, and I was envious of him. I thought, at least he can get up and walk off the vent, and I can't. And now I'm envious of no one. No one. I don't have that emotion of envy.
Do you think that your patients are ever almost reluctant to tell you their problems, thinking like, "Oh, this will sound kind of trite because, you know, he can't walk and I'm complaining about that my mother hollered at me yesterday"?
Yes, they do say that. They do say that. I mean, my position on that is suffering. Quadriplegia is a fact. A history of child abuse is a fact. But suffering is suffering. I mean, if you're not able to sleep at night, you're suffering. I'm not suffering with quadriplegia. There was a man in my office a couple of years ago, extremely obese man with two artificial knees, sitting in a chair that was probably too low for him. So it's the end of the session, and he struggles to get out of the chair. And he's working hard. I feel badly. And I'm watching, and he knows I'm watching. And he gets up, and he takes a deep breath. And he says, "You know, Dan," he says, "as hard as it was for me to get out of the chair," he says, "I look at you, and I think, thank God I can get out of the chair. Maybe I shouldn't say it, but that's what goes through my mind." And I said, "You know, I got to be honest with you." I said, "I look at you and how hard you struggle to get out of the chair, and I think, thank God I don't have to go through that crap when I get older."
What was his reaction?
We both laughed. You know, it's all a matter of perspective. It's all a matter of how you look at it. You know, my dad used to tell a wonderful story, if I may.
Please.
As he got older, he used to say, "I'm ready to leave this vale of tears." And I said to him, "Dad, is your life that bad that you're really ready to go?" And I said, he said, "Some days." I said, "Well, tell me about those days." He said, "Well, I get to thinking, my wife is gone, my daughter's gone, my sister had died 5 years earlier, and here's my son struggling through life every day in a wheelchair." He said, "Those days I'm ready to go." I said, "But Dad, those things are true every day. Tell me about the days you're not ready to go." He says, "I'm not thinking about those things." It's all perspective. It's all where your mind lands is how you read your life and how you experience it.
Well, he's ready to kill himself because you're in a chair, and of course you're not feeling that way about it when he's saying this.
Well, the truth of the matter is...
You were?
No, not at all. The truth of the matter is I would much rather be a quadriplegic than be a parent of a quadriplegic.
Really? Why?
Oh, the helplessness he felt watching me every day in his life. The powerlessness, the stories he told himself about my suffering. I mean, I can't imagine. I've watched both my daughters be ill, and I suffered more than they did. I watched my wife when I went back to work as a quadriplegic. I was hospitalized for a year, and I went back to the clinic I worked in, and it was very difficult for me, and the staff was unkind to me. And her rage and helplessness at them. Meanwhile, I had the ability to work it out with them. I was in there. I worked it out with them. I was fine. She could never forgive them because the person she loved was suffering, and there was nothing she could do about it. You know, the famous psychoanalyst Sheldon Kopp said, "The most difficult part of love is dealing with your helplessness in the face of a loved one's suffering." And that's what it means to be a parent of a quadriplegic.
You have a column in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and you know, people often write letters, and you respond. You print their letter and respond in the column. And I want to read an excerpt of a letter you wrote back in your column to somebody. And this was somebody who was saying that it was a man who wrote, and his girlfriend was emotionally disabled, basically, by having been abused as a child and having been abused as a woman. And and this man left her, but they're having a lot of troubles in their relationship. And you gave him this advice: if you decide to stay in the relationship, do so with integrity. Be in a relationship with the woman she is and not the woman you think she could be or will be. Many men get involved with women who they see as wounded and then try to rescue them from their injuries. Please don't do that. It's disrespectful, and it almost always fails. And I'm wondering if people have tried to rescue you and have tried to, like, build a relationship around trying to rescue you, and if you found it disrespectful.
Always. It's always disrespectful. Unsolicited advice is always self-serving. And it's, I don't need to be rescued. When I want help, I'll ask for it. None of us need to be rescued. We're, by and large, we are okay. And
is that a phenomenon you faced a lot, though, of people wanting to rescue you and trying to build a relationship around that?
No. It hasn't happened often. And maybe it's the message I put out there. What I face often is people wanting to be of help to me. And I almost feel badly about that because I see the best in people every day. I see their kindness and their compassion and their openness. And somebody who appears strong and healthy and independent doesn't see what I see.
You mentioned earlier that you're part of the first generation of people with quadriplegia who have lived into their late 50s, that, you know, medical science has gotten to that point. And you've nearly died a couple of times. You've come really close. At the same time, you have people who have been able-bodied, weren't in accidents, and who have died. Your ex-wife died. Your sister had a brain tumor and died. I'm just thinking of like the relative length of life that the people who had seemed healthy, some people who had seemed healthy, have already left.
I don't know how to respond, Terry. You know, Franklin Abbott, a sociologist, said that we couldn't have life without death. We couldn't understand it. The closer I come to death, and I feel I come closer every day, feel it, know it, touch it, the more that happens, the more precious I feel daytime is, nighttime, colors, knowing you, being here, writing this book, the more grateful I feel for what I have. The imminence of death just makes life more alive. I don't know, Terry, if we could do it without smelling death.
You've done a radio show at WHYY in Philadelphia for many years. How many years is that, 20?
20.
And, you know, you interview a lot of people, psychologists, psychiatrists, all kinds of people related to human relationships, human problems. And you also give a lot of advice on the telephone. What have you learned over the years about where the line is between advice that you feel you can give on the phone and what is inappropriate to presume on the telephone on a radio show with other people listening? Because you haven't had the chance to talk to the person one-on-one for a long period of time. And it's also, it's a public communication. It's not a private communication.
It's a great question, and I don't know if I have a great answer. A lot of it is instinct, which is a horrible answer. I don't diagnose someone over the phone. I don't give specific advice over the phone. And any advice I give to anyone over the phone, I am fully conscious of thousands of ears, hopefully thousands of ears, listening at the same time. And I'm talking to all of them at the same time. What I try to address to my listeners, to the caller, is the human aspect of the dilemma that they're struggling with. And if I can address the human aspect of it, then it's relevant to everybody who's listening to it.
You ask a lot of questions, too, when someone calls, don't you usually?
I'm a therapist. That's what we're trained to do. I went to school for 16 years to learn how to say, why?
So does therapy help you as an interviewer? You know, do the skills of a therapist help you with the skills as an interviewer on your radio show?
Very much so. Mm-hmm. Very much. They started off helping me a lot, and then I had to hone them because I could sit for 50 minutes easily with one patient and be very interested, but that doesn't make for good radio, the kinds of questions I've asked. My years on the radio has helped me hone my question and get to the heart of things very quickly.
So radio's helped you as a therapist?
Radio's helped me as a therapist a great deal. I'm much more efficient as a therapist. One thing I learned, a patient came to me years ago, and she said, I feel like my soul is a prism, and everybody I know only sees one color, and nobody sees the whole prism. And I thought, that's the way to be a good therapist. It's the way to be a good parent, a good spouse, a good lover. is to see the prism of somebody else's soul. And that's what I do as a therapist, as a radio interviewer, even as a friend. I work very hard to see the prism of somebody else's soul. And that's what my questions are geared towards. Help me see the prism of your soul.
It sounds like you have a really good perspective on life and death and on your physical limitations with quadriplegia. And you said before there's no one that you envy. Like, you've put that kind of envy behind you. Are there times, though, where it just gets to you and you don't have such a clear view? You don't have such a good handle on the world and your emotions and all of that.
Oh, often, I don't feel envy. That doesn't mean I don't suffer. I remember a couple of years ago, I was driving in my van and I saw somebody jogging on the drive one spring day. And I just burst into tears. I had to pull over to the side of the road. I was crying so hard. I suffer greatly. I suffer that my bladder is failing. I suffer. I feel great pain during the day. But I say to people, my body is broken. My mind is neurotic. And my soul is at peace. And that is really true. It's really true. I suffer with my body. On occasion, I suffer with my mind. And my soul really is at peace today. And I pray it's at peace tomorrow, too. And I pray it's at peace when I'm in my deathbed.
Well, Dan Gottlieb, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you. It was delightful.
Dr. Dan Gottlieb is the author of the new book, Letters to Sam. He hosts the family therapy call-in show, Voices in the Family, on WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And he writes a column for the Philadelphia Inquirer.